Just because he talks funny doesn't mean he has the right to make fun of my accent. While we're coming in, my favorite story about talking funny. We first came to the United States in 1971, and it was the first time I'd been out of South Africa. And we had managed to get cheap airline tickets from Boston, where I was going to visit with a friend who was on faculty at Dartmouth College, and then hop, skip, and jump across the United States, because this particular ticket was offered by Delta, as I remember, allowed you to make three stopovers, and it was like $100. It was dirt cheap. So we decided it was a good way to look at the country before we ended up in Los Angeles, and so we'd been to New York and forget where else, but I wanted to go down to Houston, Texas to see cowboys. I'd grown up on cowboy movies, and Texas is cowboys, isn't it? That's what I thought. So Houston, that looks like it's Texas. Let's go see if we can see some cowboys. And there's this concrete jungle there. You know, we did see cowboys. They wore Stetsons and long pointed shoes and so on. And then three-piece suits in between, you know, the cowboy hat and cowboy boots. But and finally we found a store, a shop, that sold cowboy paraphernalia. And it was really fun. And we oohed and we aahed and we looked at this and we looked at that. And there's a young clerk keeping eye on the store. And I noticed that whenever we moved, I had three little daughters with me and my wife, and we were looking at something. He would come and stand close by, and we was dusting, and we move over, and he would always be close by. And finally, he came up and said, "Y'all talk funny." And I said, "Well, I suppose we do." He said, "Where are you from?" So I said, "Well, we're from South Africa." "Oh, yeah, South Africa. South Africa. What part of Texas is that?" True story. True story. "What part of Texas is that?" 4 hour closing session today. I want to turn your attention to the topic of burnout. Sorry we ran out of time. I had a good discussion with a few people at the back on the sleep issue, and I might as well just get it in at this point, that the critical issue with sleep is the dream sleep. Sleep falls into two categories, non-dream sleep and dream sleep. And if you do mainly physical labor, you need the non-dream sleep. Doesn't matter whether you dream or not. But if you do mental work, you need dream sleep. And the dream sleep for the brain is exactly like a program that a computer has called defragmentation. You defrag your hard drive, because when you've used it for a while, it starts to have temporary files all over the place, and everything becomes disjointed. And so what you have to do is defragmentate it, put it back all together, and dump all superfluous data, etc. Now that is exactly, I mean exactly, what dream sleep does for the brain. Now, what happens to your computer if you don't defragment it regularly? Slows down. What do you think happens to the brain if it doesn't get enough dream sleep? Slows down. Same thing. Sluggish. Now, the problem is this. Well, two problems. The first problem is that the sleep needed, the amount of sleep needed by a normal, healthy adult is 9 hours. Minimum. Poke him in the ribs and say, or say, minimum. Minimum. 9 hours. It's interesting how you always have to say something here. Is this a tradition of Beeson Institute? Where it's 9 hours minimum for a healthy adult. You sleep in 1.5 hour blocks, and the dream sleep comes at the end of a sleep cycle. So if for example, you set an alarm clock, and the alarm goes off while you are dreaming in that last sleep cycle, and you interrupt that dream, it's exactly the same as what would happen if when you were in the middle of a defragmentation routine on your computer, you turned off the computer. Idiot. Same thing. You know, so I challenge you this. The next time your alarm clock interrupts your final dream cycle of the night, keep a record of what sort of day you have following that. It'll be about the most miserable day of your life. Everything will go wrong. You will make mistakes. You will be irritable. All of that stuff. All of that stuff. And so in order to get enough dream sleep, you have to sleep essentially 6 cycles. Which at 1.5 hours makes 9 hours. Every 1.5 hours you wake up, that's when you turn over. You awake just for a few minutes. In the early first few cycles, you fall straight back asleep again. You don't even remember you woke up. But then usually about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, you notice that you've woken up. And that's a very difficult period to get back to sleep again, because once you've sort of realized you're awake, your mind kicks in and you need some exercises to deal with that. My book, Habits of the Mind, has a whole bunch of exercises that are very good to practice in those early hours of the morning. It puts you to sleep as easy as you can believe. the last thing I want to say about sleep is that two last things, and then I'll move on. You have to fatigue yourself enough to be physically tired, to get enough non-dream sleep in order to get the dream sleep, because the dream sleep is at the end of the non-dream cycle. So it's like having it at the bottom of the bottle. You've got to drink everything else to get to it. So exercise is absolutely crucial to good sleep hygiene. Secondly, good sleep hygiene, avoid caffeine like the plague. Caffeine is a stimulant to your adrenal system. That's bad enough, because adrenaline is a problem anyway. So what, you know, you add the extra stimulant because you need that sort of activation. But after 3 o'clock in the afternoon, avoid all caffeine, because caffeine not only stimulates the adrenal system, it also targets certain sleep receptors and blocks them and makes sleep difficult. Or to put it technically, the sleep architecture is disturbed by caffeine. You will suffer from a sleep problem if you use excessive caffeine. Last thing, the best sleep hygiene of all is always to go to bed at the same time every night. Your brain has several clocks in it, but one very important clock, the diurnal clock that's in the brain. Brain has a clock, a timepiece in there. And it's set by the time you go to bed. So if you go to bed at different times every night, this clock is thoroughly confused. It's not unlike the time change we do twice a year, 1 hour back, 1 hour forward. That can be very discombobulating. But when you do that every day, you imagine what your brain just cannot function correctly. All right, thank you. I wanted to be able to just share that. Now let's turn to the problem of burnout. Stress is over arousal of the adrenal system. Burnout is the consequence of over arousal of the emotional system. A good synonym for burnout is demoralized. Demoralized. I have a definition up there. Burnout is a syndrome of emotional exhaustion, depersonalization, and reduced personal accomplishment that occurs in individuals who work with people. Truck drivers do not burn out. Burnout, the whole concept comes to us from the drug culture of the 60s, where they noticed that people, as a consequence of excessive drug use, literally wore themselves out. And that's not what happens in burnout today, but that concept that they were literally burned out, that concept has been borrowed to describe this rather unique phenomenon that exists only in people who work with people. I've seen it and treated it in physicians. I've seen it in people with certain types of vocation where there is a lot of people intensity. The person who works at the complaints counter of a store, burnout. And above all of them, running in the lead way above everybody else, are pastors. The burnout risk for pastors is extremely high. It is a very, very common phenomenon. In a lot of the literature, a lot of the books that have been written, unfortunately, confuse burning out and stressing out and treat them as if they're one and the same thing. But what I would like you to do is to imagine that these are two parallel but different roads. The stress road that ultimately leads to the cardiovascular disease, more emotionally to depression, cortisol blocking the receptors that leads to a biological depression. And burnout is a parallel but a different road that also has depression as the consequence, but now the depression is more of an emotional depression. It's the result of profound sense of loss. So these are parallel roads that can sometimes intertwine. So I am not suggesting that, you know, that one is not capable of both, but in my clinical experience, I've either see people who are predominantly stressed out or predominantly burned out. Because in the advanced stages of burnout, what you get is a reduced productivity, a reduced ability, reduced energy to be able to work. And so it takes you over. Now, stress will kill you. Burnout will never kill you. You'll just wish you were dead. That phrase that I mentioned from 2 Corinthians chapter 4 is a very appropriate one. Paul uses the phrase, we do not lose heart. And then again in verse 16, we do not lose heart. And losing heart, for me, emotionally says what I mean by burnout. And we'll go through some of the symptoms of that in a moment. The causes of burnout. What can cause burnout? Situational conflicts, inadequate support. I'm not going to elaborate on these. I think they're fairly straightforward. Inadequate rewards. I have a physician friend who runs, he actually owns an emergency room and he runs that. He works enormously long hours. But then every now and again he takes off and he vanishes for a week or two and he goes to exotic places all around the world, the French Riviera, you know, places like that. In other words, what I'm saying is that his rewards are so sufficient that they seem to offset the demoralizing effect of his job. And so it's amazing how if the rewards are there, it can counteract the effects. If you don't have rewards, and I'm not just talking about financial rewards, when there's no affirmation, where there's no support, where there's no encouragement, where there's no recognition of just how tough things are going right now, when all that stuff is lacking, the impact of the burnout is even more profound than otherwise. next slide. Who does and doesn't burn out? Determined idealists. Those who are overcommitted. Now, isn't it good to be overcommitted? No. It's good to be committed. But the very over means, you know, excessively. I want to illustrate for you with a few stories as I go what I'm getting at when I talk about burnout. My wife and I regularly go to Northern Vermont district of the Salvation Army to do conferences for Salvation Army officers in that region. It's the only part of the Salvation Army that I've ever built a connection with. And my wife and I have really fallen in love with them. I'd drop everything in order to just go and be with them. It's a wonderful, wonderful experience for me to be there. And they are so needy, so needy. In fact, my wife and I are honorary colonels in the Salvation Army because we've gone there so often. They've given us this certificate and so on. But there was a problem, though, with that, because I noticed when I got my certificate that I was an honorary lieutenant colonel, and she was an honorary full colonel. I didn't notice it at first, but those rascals had intentionally given her a higher rank than me, which you're not supposed to do in the Salvation Army because husband and wife have exactly the same rank. Can you imagine the marital problems you would have if your wife had a higher rank than you? Well, but at any rate, we go there. But so we were there, and I forget what topics we were addressing, but after one session, this young Salvationist, I judged her to be maybe 28, 30, came, she's single, came to talk, said, could I talk to you? And we went aside, and we started to talk, and I could just see the tears starting to stream. And I just looked at her, you can see it in the eyes, burnout, you see it in the eyes. It's just the face gives it away. And she tells me the story. Her responsibility is to run the kitchen, the feeding kitchen in the Boston, downtown Boston area, where they have all the homeless and so on. That's her job. But not only her job to run it, clear instructions. You find the food for it. You find the money to run it. You get someone to cook the food. You serve it. Don't come and bother me with the details. Those were instructions. Okay. You know, what else can she do? She'd been working at it 3 or 4 years. Things were getting so bad, that she decided to get up a half hour earlier in the morning just to pray that God would somehow move people, restaurants, whatever, to make the food available. And then she added an hour. And at the time I was speaking to her, she was getting up 3 o'clock in the morning to pray for God to send the food. Well, how am I going to face those hungry faces one more time? Those little children. I give them my food. I just stood there and I was really moved. Well, burnout. That's what burnout's all about. A week later, I was preaching at the Crystal Cathedral. I stood in the pulpit, Robert Schuller, and I stood there and I looked around at a fairly wealthy, affluent congregation, and this woman's face just came to me. I don't know what Schuller must have thought. But I started weeping. He was trying to be upbeat, possibility thinking. Mary, the mother of Jesus, was a possibility thinker. That's why she was the mother of Jesus. She no more wanted to be a mother than anyone I know. But I stood there and I wept. I said, you know what? If I just said, each one of you, give me $1, I could keep her in food for 3 months, probably. I felt so ashamed. I asked myself, is this the church? Now, I'm not trying to be... I understand about wealth and its distribution, but there's something in the church that's missing when we can't acknowledge that there are people who desperately need, And so my wife and I, we give generously and try to help. But the point is those are the conditions. And I think I've spelled them out in the next slide. Well, first of all, who doesn't burn out? Who doesn't? Type A, B personalities burn out a little more than type A's. Type A's are so driven by adrenaline. They're always starting new projects. If something's not working, they go find another one. And so type A's have the capacity and the energy to escape their restrictive environment and go and create a new one if they need to. But type B's feel things more deeply. It affects them more personally. And so they carry the burden. They tend to be more sympathetic and carry the burden, and therefore are a little bit more prone to burnout than others. The essential difference between burnout and stress then, well, I've said that, over-arousal. Differences between burnout and stress, the next slide, is just a repeat, I think, of what I've just said. two major types of burnout, if I can get to that slide, please. Burnout occurs under one of two conditions. Now, a type A person can burn out under certain conditions. Sometimes when the resources that they rely on tend not to deliver for them, then they will begin to experience the process of burnout as well. Type A's also have the advantage, I should add, that because they are often more gregarious, they are often more able to make social connections and build social supports systems, they can often protect themselves from burnout. Type B's, by their very nature, are a little less so, or at least some type B's. My wife's a type B, but she's as gregarious as they come. I mean, she can walk into an elevator that's going up three flights of stairs full of people and will know every one of them before she gets to the third floor. I mean, this is just remarkable, but she can do that. But type B's, therefore, don't rely, they tend to be more private, and therefore they lack the support, the dependence that can be very helpful in preventing burnout. Isolation is what I'm saying. Isolation is a dead ringer for burnout. There are two major types of burnout where you can think of burnout as occurring under two conditions. One is the acute condition. That means it comes on suddenly. The term is borrowed from medicine. We talk about an acute illness. That means, pneumonia comes on suddenly. It's an acute illness. As opposed to a chronic illness. Fibromyalgia is a chronic illness. It comes on slowly, insidiously, and eating away at your body. And so, as in burnout, we can have an acute burnout and a chronic burnout. And the difference is absolutely important in one very, very important, significant way. And that is, in acute burnout, where it is sudden in onset, the recovery is fairly rapid. Fairly rapid. But chronic burnout, that sits, I'm going to sort of, whenever I come this side, I'm looking at acute burnout folks. And whenever I go to this side, I'm looking at chronic burnout folks. In chronic burnout, because it comes on so slowly, so insidiously, you hardly know it's happening. It becomes more entrenched and is a much more difficult problem to deal with. There's a profound loss of confidence in yourself. That's important, but more importantly, in God. I have yet to encounter anyone who is severely burnt out, who throws up their hands and says, you know, that's it. There is no God. I'm just going to let it go. Never happens. The belief in God is very profound. It's just that God doesn't care about me. That young Salvation Army officer, that young woman, she prayed every day to God. But God doesn't care. I don't matter in His kingdom. That's the feeling. And that's the most profound loss of all. This loss that God has abandoned me. But the chronic burnout is slow, insidious. Many plateaus, and the decline is gradual. Now, according to research we've done, about two out of five, About 3 out of 5 clergy are burned out by the 10th year of ministry. About 3 out of 5 are already showing significant signs of burnout. The causes: situational conflicts, inadequate support, or sudden removal of support, inadequate rewards, ongoing minor conflicts. Just those little foxes, you know, eating away at the grapes, just day in and day out, that nagging, negative feedback, that person who is all constantly, that can weigh you down. That can weigh you down. I think some of those slides are repeated then. Okay, coping with acute burnout, and then I want to talk about coping with chronic burnout. For some reason, these slides are, I thought we had it all worked out, we went and checked it all, but I tell you something. Let me share with you my own personal experience of burnout. Twice in my life, I've suffered very severe burnout. The first time was shortly after I started practicing as a clinical psychologist. My working life as a civil engineer, and got promoted very rapidly. By the time I was 28, I had thousands of people. I was directing architects, other engineers, and construction workers, and so on. And I became a people manager, and I realized how inadequate I was at 28. What do you know at 28? Nothing. So I went to my boss and I said, you know, it would really help me if I had some psychology behind me. And I was thinking industrial psychology. Do you think I could go and enroll in an industrial psychology degree? You know? He said, that's a great idea. Sure, take whatever time you need and I'll pay all the expenses. And so part of my engineering agreement with him was that I would, you know, prepare myself to be more sophisticated in psychology. But after a year, I fell in love with clinical psychology because I realized that when you work with people, clinical is far better than industrial. And 10 years later, I sat up and I had my PhD in clinical psychology, but I was still working as an engineer. And so I never dreamed I would leave engineering. I got big bucks. It was so well paid. Why would I want to give that up for a rinky-dink salary that psychologists get? So I built a consulting room on my home, and my plan was to do the sort of Paul thing, tent building thing. I would earn my keep as an engineer, and then in the evenings and sometime of the weekends, I would put in a few hours doing clinical work. And at that point, it was mainly with clergy and their families. That's all I wanted to do. After a few months, you know, so word gets out, I found that every night, till 11, 12 o'clock at night, I was seeing clients. And so I started Saturday morning, and it was all day Saturday. And within 6 months, I was working 8 to 5 as an engineer, come home, have a quick bite to eat, go into my consulting room, probably not be out of there until midnight, up again the next morning, including Saturday. And then it was Sunday afternoons. One day, the telephone rang. And I jumped. I don't know, 5 feet, 4 feet, maybe 2 feet. Okay, 6 inches. 6 inches. I jumped. I just jumped and I started screaming, "Shut that bloody thing off!" I just screamed and you know, I just let go. I lost it. One more person calling and asking for help. I have nothing more to give. Finished. And that was it. Next day, my wife and I had a careful, long conversation. I'd been communicating with Fuller Seminary to go there as a postdoctoral fellow. And that next afternoon, we decided, Time to quit. And I shut all that down, and 3 months later we were on our way to the United States to go to Fuller, where they'd invited me to come as a postdoc. Ever since that day, and that's now nearly 34 years ago, ever since that day I have hated the telephone. I cannot stand the ring of a telephone. Today still. The telephone is demon possessed. It's the curse. I do not answer the telephone. My wife answers the phone. It's just one of those things. But this sense of, you know, nothing more I can do to stem the tides, nothing more I can offer. And it took me, I am not exaggerating, it took me all of 7 years before I felt like I was over it. And that's the problem with a chronic burnout, is that it can take a long, long time for it to come straight. The second time occurred when I was dean of our graduate school of psychology, and our provost had died, and we didn't have a provost, and I went to David Hubbard, our president, and I said, "You know, Dave, I'm sufficient as a dean. I know what I'm doing. Let's forego our weekly meetings. I know that your schedule is crowded now. I'll give that time back to you. If I need you, I'll give you a call." And so I embarked on a sort of lonely journey of being a dean, and I cut off my support. Now, the thing about support is it doesn't come from the bottom up. It comes from the top down. Do not look downwards for your support. You have to look upwards. Either peers, equals, or upwards. You are the source of support for those downward. You are not dependent for your support from them. And I cut off the support from David, and I can't believe how quickly, in a matter of 5 or 6 weeks, I felt this burnout coming back on again. I just felt it coming on. I didn't need Hubbard to help me make decisions. But there is something about knowing every week there is this 1 hour when I can go and sit down and I can talk things out with my president, where I can run things by him, where I can get his affirmation, that's good, that's right, no, maybe that we shouldn't go that way, we should go this way. That sense, that confidence building that comes from that support. But not all of that's important, but most important of all, the ability to externalize what's going on inside. The ability to externalize what's going on inside. And that is perhaps, I'm jumping a little ahead of myself, I'll get into dealing with chronic burnout in a moment, but while I'm sort of hot on the topic, let me just drive that point home. The best protection you have against burnout is to have a place where you can go and externalize what's going on in your thick skull, your dumb head. Because the externalizing of what's going on in your thinking processes helps to put your brain in order again, helps to put things in perspective. It's the isolated, shut out, cut out, not having a support system that your system disintegrates. That's the only way I can say it. Your system disintegrates. The power of externalization. Do you ever wonder why it is that with a zillion different types of psychotherapy out there, they all claim to be effective? Do you ever wonder about that? And I've always wondered about it. And the fact is that there is one common denominator. And that is people sit and talk and listen to themselves. Sigmund Freud's daughter became a prominent psychoanalyst, and she was visiting the United States once. She only speaks German, Austrian, couldn't understand any English, but they had a cocktail party for her, and she went to this cocktail party, and a lady pulled her aside and in English started to unburden herself to Dr. Freud. And she just went on, and then Dr. Freud would stand there nodding her head knowingly. After a little while, this lady just took her hand and said, "Oh, Dr. Freud, you have no idea how helpful you have been. Thank you so much." And she kissed her hands like that and walked away. And Dr. Freud's friend walked up and said to her in German, "You know, what was that all about?" And Dr. Freud said, "I have no idea. I didn't understand a word she was saying." but she was profoundly helpful. This is the externalization process. When you talk with someone else, you are listening. That's the magic about it all. And that is going back into your brain and reprocessing things. We have to talk it out. There's also an interesting story told about Albert Einstein. As you know, Albert Einstein lived in Pasadena for a while, long before I got there. But I've always had a fascination with Einstein. I mean, the greatest brain that has ever lived. And just to think, I often think, well, just down the road, Albert Einstein walked these roads. It has a sort of nice feeling for me. But Einstein's famous paper in which he proposed the theory of relativity is an interesting one. He had been rejected, as you know, probably the University of Basel would not accept his doctoral thesis, said it was too colorful and fanciful. So he took it somewhere else, and finally he got his PhD, then could not get a position as a physicist in any university. So the only job he could get was a patent examiner in Vienna. And so he ended up as a patent examiner. But he kept working on his theory of relativity. But he couldn't finish it. He could not get it done. And so he one day called a friend of his, also a physicist, and invited him to come down to Vienna and visit with him, because he wanted to share it with his friend. And he and his friend, we read, took a walk in the Vienna woods. And Freud began to outline his theory of relativity. And he said, you know, and he developed it. And at a certain point like this, Freud stopped and said, I've got it. Excuse me. Turns around, runs back to his study, abandoning his friend in the Vienna woods. And he goes and sits down and he writes the last two paragraphs of his famous treatise on the theory of relativity. That paper has no references at all. There was no one else to reference. It was totally... But it ends with a brief statement in which he thanks his friend, so-and-so, for listening to him as he explained his theory. And in the process of explaining it, he put it all together. And I say to myself, now how come I think I can solve all my problems just by thinking about them, when Albert Einstein couldn't do that? And it speaks powerfully to the immensely important importance of listening, of having good listeners, of having a support system that listens, having spouses that listen, having parents that listen. So, dealing with chronic burnout, a few comments about coping with acute burnout. Acute burnout, because it comes on suddenly, can usually be stopped fairly suddenly. You stop the slide. You literally try to bring under control what is happening. I liken it to walking along the edge of a precipice. Often when I'm at the beach, I will get a section that's fairly steep and drops away. And I like to walk as close as I can to the edge to see how close I can get to the edge. And every now and again, the soil underneath me gives way, you know, and you sort of slide down. That's quite fun to see how close you can get. But that's acute burnout. You see, suddenly you're walking along and you don't know how to realize how close you are to the edge, but suddenly it gives way and down. So what you have to do is you have to grab at something. You clasp at anything. You stop anything. Because in acute burnout, what you have to deal with is the helplessness of it all. And anything that can restore a sense of helplessness can stop that slide. I will sit a pastor down, you know, recently if there's a pastor that an Air Force base was going to get closed. The little church that he'd been developing, had planted and had developed, depended on the Air Force base for its clientele mainly. Now there's an announcement they're going to close the Air Force base. This was a few years ago. And he just went into, you know, just down into depression, and the burnout just accelerated. So I sat him down and I said, well, we've got to find something that you feel you can take control of here. Well, is there something you can do? Is there something you can go and do? He said, well, suppose I could go and mow the lawn at the church. I said, go do it. Came back a week later and he was back in control again. Just, it's nothing more than being a symbolic gesture to your brain. No, it's not hopeless. Do you remember that famous painting of a chessboard with Satan on the one side playing chess and the young man on the other side, and they're playing chess, and hovering over them was a big angel. And the painting is labeled Checkmate. And with a big grin on his face, Satan is sitting there, I got you checkmated. A famous chess player was studying that painting one day, and went away and came back, and went away and came back, and said, I want to talk to the curator. I want to talk to the curator. The king still has one move. It wasn't checkmate at all. The king still has one move. That's, you have to find something that can redeem your confidence and put you back in control. I have a friend, I knew someone a little while, some years ago, who was an astronaut. He's one of the men that gone to the moon. They are phenomenal people, those. I mean, those are supermen. I just marvel at them. But he'd been to the moon, and for his first trip to the moon, he was in the command capsule that sent the men down to the moon, and he had to stay while it circled around the moon all by himself. And going onto the dark side of the moon, his capsule started to tumble out of control. No communication with Earth, capsule out of control. I would have gone berserk. And, you know, I talked with him about this. I said, I can't believe that a human being could sit there and remain calm. He said, well, you know, it's how they design all this. You are not left feeling helpless. I said, well, what did you do? He said, well, first thing I sat up and I looked at the manuals. There's a whole bunch of manuals right above my head. And I looked for the one that says, capsule tumbling out of control on dark side of moon. And I pulled it down, you know, and I turned to the first page. Turn switch XYZ off. XYZ, XYZ, ding. Turn PQR on. Ding. You know, and for the next 5 minutes, there's something I've got to do. There's a sense, and that, see, psychologically was provided by the designers, because in fact, computers can do all that. But then what do people do? But just the symbolism, the symbolic meaning of having a little thing to do, go mow that lawn, go tidy my desk, go prepare next week's sermon, is sufficient to restore a sense of control. And that's important in acute burnout. And I move to chronic burnout, because basically the two are very much the same. Preventing and recovering from burnout, if I can just go to that. Preventing and recovering from burnout. Remember that in burnout, depression plays a key role in terms of the symptom picture. Depression plays a key role. And when burnout has been around a long time, and with it an appropriate depression, then what happens is that becomes a stressor to the system that raises cortisol levels, that blocks the neurotransmitters, receptors, and before you know it, you now have a biological depression, although it started out as a psychological one. And so in chronic burnout, you really have to explore the option of trying an antidepressant medication to test for whether or not the biochemistry has been affected by this prolonged, even though it's gradual onset, this prolonged state of burnout. And we call it diagnosis by trial medication. You know, should I be on medication or not? Well, try it for 6 weeks. If it works, bingo. There's no test for it. There's no way we can prove it. If it doesn't work, well, we'll try something else. And in chronic burnout, you really must give attention to the appropriateness of using an antidepressant medication. And while I'm on that, since I'm not talking about depression at this conference, let me say this. Please do not put antidepressant medications in the same category as other psychotropic medications. I was listening to a broadcast a couple of days ago, and this very erudite, this very, very smart person really made the mistake of lumping it together with certain other psychotropic medications. When you take something like Ritalin, for example, you're taking a mind-altering drug. When a normal person takes Ritalin, they will also have enhanced memory function and learning ability, not only the person who suffers from ADD. So for a normal person to be taking that drug is sort of, you know, it's almost like an emotional steroid. It's not appropriate, is what I'm trying to say. And this person was making a parallel with that. Well, you see all these antidepressants now. All it's doing is giving people enhanced feelings of well-being. No, it doesn't. Listen, an antidepressant only fixes an error. If there is nothing wrong with your brain chemistry, an antidepressant... She had an excessive level of sympathy toward those she was helping. Sympathy is what drives a lot of human compassion. But we know from the clinical world that sympathy in the long run is not an adequate method for expressing compassion. In contrast to sympathy, you know, the clinical world has suggested the idea of empathy. And I personally think that scripture is more akin to what empathy is than sympathy. And let me tell you why I believe that. The problem with sympathy is you say to somebody, I know how you feel because I'm feeling it with you. That's what sympathy is, a resonant feeling. My middle daughter's husband was killed tragically in an automobile accident 10 years ago. The next morning, I had to sit down with my two grandsons, 10 and 12 years of age, and tell them that Daddy died last night. It wasn't fun. After a couple of months, my daughter, who just lives down the road, fortunately, so we could step in to be helpful and supportive, a dear Christian lady, I mean, she was, you know, she was well-intended, went to my daughter and said, Sharon, I just want you to know that I haven't slept a wink since Richard died. I just want you to know that I have lain awake every night feeling your pain. Sharon said, Dad, I wanted to throw up. If she really thought that that level of pain on her part was helpful to me, she got it all wrong. You see, that's the problem with sympathy. It judges other people's feelings by how they are feeling, and then in some strange way thinks that they can suffer for that other person. As opposed to empathy. Empathy says, I just have no idea. I have no idea whatsoever what it must feel like for you. But I'd like you to share it with me. And you see, as clinicians, that's what we learn. We train our students to be empathic, not sympathetic. How much sympathy can you carry to a broken world? And the theology of it is all wrong. Because the theology says, you know, if I hurt with you, I am suffering for you. Somehow that must do something for God. And I want to scream at these people and say, would you get off the cross? Jesus suffered for me. I don't need you. And I have to say that to myself whenever I'm drawn up sympathetically. God does not need my sacrifice. Oh yes, but the scripture says we must weep with those that weep. And whenever they throw that verse at me, they never finish it. What's the second part of it? Rejoice with those that rejoice. They just want to do the first, not the latter. I weep with my patients all the time. But there's a difference when I weep out of empathy because I understand what they feel, as opposed to weeping because I'm sympathetic and I want to bear their pain with them. And the problem with so many pastors and Christian workers, and I see it in missionaries, and as what lay people make the mistake is they think that I think that their sympathy is merely a guilt alleviation. So they make themselves feel bad because they really are feeling guilty that it happened to the other person and not them. So that's my first suggestion, that we develop a healthy theology of compassion. Then I think it's important that you develop a healthy theology of success. Burnout, the risk of burnout has escalated dramatically with the shift in recent decades towards a success-driven ministry. Now, please don't misunderstand me here. I understand the church growth movement. I knew Donald McGovern personally. I know where he was coming from. And one has to be intentional and proactive and strategic and all that stuff. But I think, though, that we have to really go back and rethink the theology of this. What drives it? Because if you're too focused on being successful, then the problem is that every failure becomes a devastating one. And so going along with a healthy theology of success that I suggested to you earlier has to be predicated upon the faithfulness issue. It's the marathon race runner who has clearly in her or his mind that if I'm going to finish this race, I have to pace myself. I pace myself. And the first person out of the pack, I've watched many marathon races down in Hawaii. We always seem to be there when the marathon is on. And I had the first person out of that pack. I wish someone would take bets on that person not winning the race, because I would win every time. Because the first person out is never going to win. You look for the middle of the pack, someone who is oblivious to how others are running, and then sets his or her own pace, and they will finish. Then thirdly, counterbalance the theology of success on the one hand and of failure on the other. A theology of failure. I preached our baccalaureate service at Fuller a couple of years ago. And I struggled to know what to preach about. And then finally, I'm going to talk about failure. And I basically started my sermon along the lines of, well, you've all come to the end of your seminary training. Some of you have been here 6 or 7 years, you know, in our doctoral program. Some of you are MDivs now. You've been here 3 years or whatever, and you're about to graduate. But I'm going to apologize. I'm going to apologize on behalf of this faculty, because there's something we have not taught you all the years you've been with us. We have not taught you how to deal with failure. And I want to correct that this morning. And laid out to know, a theology of failure is as important as any theology of success. Success is built upon a mountain of failures. And in the final analysis, in God's kingdom, there is no such thing as failure, only forced growth. The most profound failure I ever experienced was the event that turned me away from engineering in order to pursue a career in clinical psych. The only way God could get me detached, because I'm an engineering type person, and if God had any hand in it, and I sometimes think I'm presumptuous even suggesting that, but if God had any hand in it, I know the only way he could have got me out of engineering was to set me up for a failure. Sometimes burnout is God's plan for your life. Sometimes failure is God's plan for his life. And I think that one of the presentations earlier this morning suggested that, you know, that sometimes something's got to die so that better things can be born. I think, wasn't that the president who said that? And I think that is absolutely right. No, I think God does his finest work in moments of brokenness and failure. Because then he has our total attention. And then lastly, a theology of self-care. And you've had a lot of that already this weekend, so I don't want to add any further comments to that, except to say that that the pastor who is not caring of his own self can't possibly know how to care for others, because I think that it comes out of your own self-care. It's because I want to love God above everything else that I'm motivated to get others to love themselves. And by the way, dump all the dualisms. My wife, my dear wife, you know, she's chaplain to student wives in Fuller Seminary. And I often hear her preaching to her wives something like, well, you know, I love God first, and then I love my husband, and then I love my children and all that thing. I have to correct her. I say, honey, that's dualistic. That's not how it is. I don't love God more than you. The more I love you, the more I love God. The more I love God, the more I love you. If we could just see that in our marriage, that my love for my wife is reflective of my love for God. Not that I love him more. I don't think God wants me to love him more than that. But if I love him, I can love my wife and my children and my people. Now, if I love my people and my children and my wife, I love God better. I love God better. God bless you all. You've been wonderful. Thank you.